This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello everyone. 大家好.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamualaikum.
And kia ora. Kia ora everyone. Welcome back to Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for, and about the multicultural people of Dunedin and New Zealand. We have Ivan Yeo from Authenticity Studios with us today. Ivan is based in Auckland. We met in Dunedin a couple of years ago, so I'm really excited to bring him on the podcast. Kia ora, Ivan.
Kia ora, Arena, and thank you so much for having me, and selamat tengah hari.
Selamat tengah hari. Yay. So Ivan and I, we do share a shared cultural background, and we're very excited to talk about that as well. But Ivan, thank you for joining us. How would you introduce yourself to someone new?
Sure. So usually I kind of joke about it. I will tell people I was making Singapore process from Malaysian exported to New Zealand. That pretty much sum up, you know, like, which is I was born in Singapore and lived in Malaysia most of my life until I was 28. I came to New Zealand as an international student and now citizen of New Zealand. However, to be honest, despite that many years that I have been New Zealand, I'm 53, I still see Malaysia as my home. I mean, New Zealand's also home, but it's just a very different feelings because my extended families are not here. So that's where the root is. And also, I've been working in mental health sectors for almost 20 years with lived experience from rainbow communities and also many, many other different things that I do.
And would you say you've been in New Zealand half of your life? Or is
So when I became 56 would be, you know, like, based on the number would be half of my life, but it is half of my life, to be honest. Even though my formative years and adolescence and early adulthood was based in Malaysia, but I felt like I truly grown as a person only after I came to New Zealand to really find out who I am. And seeing the challenge that I have overcome throughout the years. So it's a very different feelings. Like here in New Zealand, it kind of mold me to the person I am today.
Mm. And thinking about where you grew up, so you were born in Singapore. Would you say your parents were Singaporean?
Ah, good question. My parents are actually Malaysian. At the time when Malaysia and Singapore hasn't yet introduced skilled migrants, which is from Singapore, in the early 70s or early 80s. That's why my father was able to live in Singapore, working for his own brother as a butcher. But then Singapore start introduce skilled migrants, and which is, you know, like, butcher is not a skilled migrant category. And so we all have to move back for that reason. And I can't be sure how the process were, but I understand at the time one of the challenges was that he's a butcher, so he wouldn't be able to eligibly getting work visa and all that. And most of my uncle from Malaysia, but married to Singaporean, that's why they can stay in Singapore. And to be honest, I'm so grateful that I didn't stay. That would be not my environment. I am not chill as a human being. I wouldn't enjoy myself in Singapore, to be honest. So, So Malaysia suited me way better.
So looking back now with the change in government policies, you're still happy with
Absolutely. I wouldn't choose otherwise, even though, because I'm from Johor Bahru, so which is next to Singapore, only through a coastline, and my sisters, they all, both of them, I have three elder sisters, two of them work in Singapore. And I did try for a short period of time when I just finished high school. And I just hated it. It's just not me. I mean, like, it's just too busy, too many people. I'm not saying the country is artificial, don't get me wrong, that's not what I mean. But in some way, it is quite artificial in terms of, you know, great infrastructures and all that, I agree. But something there is just not me. I just don't have that soul feelings that I need.
You didn't feel connected to the place as well?
Not at all. Yeah. So I went back to Malaysia and did fine art in diploma while working for my second sister in her restaurant. And then we're teaching children art for quite a period of time before I came to New Zealand. And actually, I didn't really share that part of my journey, which is I teach children art. I taught children art for quite a period of time, which I really enjoy, but also hard work because, you know, like children, they are quite, noisy and sometimes quite energy draining because if you teach back to back, you know, like you're trying to be upbeat, encouraging, and also while still having the awareness to how I behave, that can be very taxing. So, yeah.
Tell me about your sister's restaurant. Is that a family business?
Yeah, that's my sister's restaurant, which is like a yam cha in New Zealand. So we call it dim sum. And because we are from Johor Bahru, so there's a lot of Singaporean coming over to enjoy nightlife. And the restaurant is directly opposite the nightclubs. So it runs from evening 7 to about morning 4 or 5 o'clock. And so I work there. And it's like a family business, but it started from my sister and brother-in-law. And I was there helping her for the time when I was studying my fine art in diploma. So busy, to be honest. I still having nightmares sometimes about working in a restaurant.
Yes. Oof,
so many people, especially during weekend.
I can imagine.
But I learned a lot.
The overwhelm that you felt being there.
Yeah, especially when the nightclub finished and then you have this, you know, like customers just suddenly swarm into the restaurant. And then, wow, that can feel so overwhelmed in that 2 or 3 hours you just run with adrenaline, you know, like constantly. And that's why I'm a very fast worker, but it's hard work, to be honest. And I have done it even when I first came to New Zealand. My first job was working for a burger joint, Burger Wisconsin. And my boss loved me because I worked so fast. They call me one of the characters, I can't remember. So it's like really fast running around and able to see things from multiple perspectives and, you know, like just get things done. But man, restaurant is hard work. People, if no one has been working in a restaurant before and things easy, no. Man, this is hard work. Yeah.
And I think it's good for people to experience as well, dealing with customers. And I think just the amount of skills that you gain from a restaurant job in your early years would have been a really good good for your CV, but also your life skills.
Oh, absolutely. Because I was quite not... I can speak English, but I was like a confident standing in front of till and taking orders and all that. But my boss forced me to do it. And I'm forever grateful because I, at the time, was really worried about my accents and whether people can understand me or not. But he forced me to stand there and take order, understand, you know, like, and all that. And that helped to build confidence. I didn't even thought about it before, but it really helped me tremendously, especially, you know, like gaining that confidence is talking to Kiwi directly and understand their accents. Because at university, you have your lecturer and those English are not the same. When you're talking to lay person, I mean, like, it's so different, the jargon they use and all that. So, yeah, so I truly learned a lot from that experience.
Sounds like a really good boss.
Yeah, I was really lucky, and both of them are just amazing, treat me so well. Mm. Yeah, but I work really hard as well. So it's like it's a mutual respect.
What about culturally, growing up in Malaysia? And I think this is a good time to talk about your queerness as well and finding that out before you came to New Zealand.
Yeah, very, very good topics, to be honest, because I, despite knowing I'm gay, after I came to New Zealand, it was such a challenge to even understand what that means. You know, like, despite New Zealand society is open to gay people, legislatively, we have protection. It's not because of the social science degree that I study. Probably I wouldn't even be able to accept my own sexual orientation. And the time when I grew up, there's no internet, there's nothing as such to kind of normalize, you know, like, it's acceptable. And despite my parents, they are not homophobia or anything, but there's still that narrative about it's not okay to be gay or joke about being gay and all that. And so knowing oneself as gay person to understand, okay, New Zealand society, whether it's acceptable to then meet some gay couple who live like a normal life, it's like, oh wow, that is possible. And then to really live in that skin of being gay, it was a process, because I think I hated myself so much. I wish I could just be a normal person so that I don't have to go through what I've gone through to find that I'm a crying baby so pretty. but it's just that torment of able to say it's okay to be gay is hard. And even now, 53, I just left a relationship after 22 years, and walking back into these rainbow communities is something that I suddenly had to relearn again. And I don't think people understand the challenge of being a queer person in a mainstream society, despite we have all this acceptance. But every time when I meet someone new, I kind of still in the end have to disclose. It doesn't bother me, you know, like, even lately I went to this dancing place doing a lot of dance and having this Zumba instructor. And then I was doing one of the classes where she turned out, I couldn't recognize her because she was dressing differently. And then when I recognized her, she said, oh, it must be because she have very colorful, like a very dressed quite tight and all that. She was joking around because she wear too much. That's why I couldn't recognize her. In the end, I have to say, oh, by the way, I'm gay anyway, so it doesn't matter. It's just more.
You have to slowly tell them, yeah.
Yeah, so because people, for some reason, people still can't tell whether I'm gay or not. I don't know what it is. But then I also do Muay Thai kickboxing. I also teach Muay Thai kickboxing, but then I do dancing. So in some way, I'm quite blessed to be able to just ease in and out to different environments. But to find that self-confidence and not be bothered by it, it takes time to develop. Even if the society in New Zealand is open and all that, but making that shift has not been easy as well. And I'm not afraid of it. I have so many people who tell me they never have gay friends before. Like, I'm their first. Even now, I still have things say to me, like, oh, you're my first gay friend. Which is great, you know, like, because through me, they then able to challenge their own perceptions and understand what gay people mean. But on the other hand, means that we still have a lot of challenges in front of us. Yeah.
Mm. This is really interesting because you would think that for people who are experiencing, you know, conflict of identities, moving to a new country where it's more acceptable, you think that all of the problems just go away and you can live your life freely. But there is that idea of, you know, you still need to learn more about yourself and accept yourself. And I think self-acceptance is definitely very important in this case, so that you can truly understand what is it that you want from life and also make genuine connections with people, because you can't make genuine connections with people if you haven't really truly accepted who you are as a person as well. But I'm thinking about the younger version of you who came to New Zealand for their studies. Why did you choose New Zealand? Because it was a safer place for the rainbow communities, or did you thought about your studies first? Was identity your first in mind?
Everything happened by chance. I had an episode, a big meltdown at home, and because of that, my father and mother was really worried about me. I was at the time about 26 or 27, and I just felt so suffocating that I don't know how to move on. Like, I have this split personality where one is holding back because knowing I'm gay, how do I live the life in Malaysia if I want to be truthful about myself, which is something, a core values that I don't know where to begin, but it's just like I have to be true with myself. My whole life has been about that. And then there's another part of me wanting to compliance to the society norm and all that. So there's always this huge conflicting feelings about where should I stand. And also I'm someone who full of emotion and love, and I really want to experience what love is. To be honest, I still don't know what it is. Even now. So I have a huge fight with my mom and have a meltdown and just, you know, like I just couldn't do it anymore. And then every time when something happened, my mom would call my father. And what came first is, so what do I want to do? And then I just say, I want to go overseas. To be honest, I only earn enough to support myself. I don't have money. As a collective family, you know, like your father always your father. So he say, okay, I give you money, just do what you want to do. I say, really? So it wasn't planned. It just kind of through that process, then I decided to study English. By chance, the school recommend me to go to Australia. I went to Australia to do my IELTS test because I was an adult learner. I only have diploma, but growing up, my family speak Mandarin, and I did very poorly in school. I didn't know because I have underlying learning disability, which ADHD and also depression. So I never done well in school, never. And so, and went to Australia and then thought, oh, this is great. Let's explore how New Zealand looks like. Really, just like that.
Wow.
I have no plan. And then I just landed in New Zealand. And then just like that, I stayed. But you're right. There's a part for me trying to understand who am I without all this labor and norm that have been imposed to me. I kind of wanting environments where I can unpack myself, which I didn't have word to articulate it. And then I happened to land in social science degree as well. It wasn't even my plan. I wanted to study psychology as a matter of fact. but that have truly enabled me to understand how society will construct by norm the structures of the dominant culture and what that means, and that helped to truly unpack who I am. And even the first year when I decided to come out to my family, and that's also a very challenging process because you know they love you, but there's part of you always questions whether they still love you or not, if they know you're queer. And so that's a long time ago, but man, that fears, that questions about whether people in your life will truly love you or not just because of your sexual orientations is scary, because they are your whole life. And I give my life to my sisters. I would do everything for them. But that also come with the fear of, because I'm not cool enough, so I have to perform more to gain their acceptance. By doing so means that I am constantly putting myself second before anyone else. And I still have to relearn that, to kind of ask myself, what exactly do I want? Instead of thinking about what other people want and then put myself in a secondary situation. Yeah.
Mm, and you only got to really unpack all of that when you left the circle, the community that you grew up in. I love how everything happened by chance. It's not like, okay, New Zealand is safe for this, for people of my identity, so I will go there and I will, you know, experience and see what comes out of it. It just happened by chance and you just really followed the flow. So you came to New Zealand as an international student. Did you meet other queer people while you were here?
Yeah, I met so many of them. I met through university, because they have that rainbow community support. I met because I then start exploring the scene, you know, like, so I then came, I went to Rainbow Youth, I went to different spaces and meeting people, and I went to nightclubs, I went to, and then at university, met some friends, and that was great, because the idea is through them hearing their narrative to help me to make sense of my own experience. And I also gone to counselor and have counseling support, especially just to unpack all that nuances that I still trying to understand and come to turn, and also coming out to my parents. There was a lot of hard work, to be honest. Because when the self is so hidden and suddenly you have this freedom to say, here you go, now you can do whatever you want, which is truly, as an international student, you have the freedom. And you get excited, but also scared at the same time. It's like the animations, Rapunzel, the one that with long hair, where after she escaped from the castle, and then there's this scene, she was so excited, and was like, oh, wow! And then on the other, like, oh my God, what happened here? Yes. That was me. I like that scene, so it portrays so well about how I was feeling, you know, like you get this excitement after you've been cooped into this place for so long, and then it's like, yay! And then it's like, oh my God, I want to go back. So there's always this polarized extreme happening at the same time, because my mom asked me last time when I went back home, would I like to go back to Malaysia and live there? I said, I would love to live in Malaysia. I love Malaysia, but I know I can't, because then I can't live as who I am. The second thing is, once I told my father I want to go back to Malaysia, and then he said, why you want to come back? He's not opposing the idea I go, want to go back to Malaysia, he basically say it's not a safe country for you. As great as it sounds, as lovely as it is, with my intention to go back so that I can be with them. And I love Malaysia to a teeth, you know, like that will never be taken away, but it's the reality of being gay. Mm.
And your parents love you for realizing that it is safer for you to not be there.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wonder if we can talk about queerness from a cultural lens, because I'm sure, you know, being Chinese, Malaysian and queer has its own set of challenges to being queer from different cultures. So just thinking about like the intersectionalities of your identities, what was that like for you?
I have been fortunate. To be honest, why I say that is because of working in mental health as Chinese, as queer, and also Chinese Malaysians and speak Mandarin have been an advantage for me to get to where I am. And I'm very fortunate in early stages when peer support was just started and people see me as an asset. There's not many Chinese, Malaysians, queer who put their hands out and say, hey, I experienced mental health issues, so I want to work in a sector. So I have been very fortunate when it comes to workforce. And then because of that, I was invited and also get into many projects simply by that itself of the labels, which is crazy. So I can only talk about my experience from the mental health sector, but also in Auckland, where I have landed many jobs simply because of these labels that I carry and, of course, of also the skill that I developed. But being so many things also have its challenge, because people will either see me as Chinese or see me as gay, or see me as someone who's not Kiwi. And I have to work really hard to blend into the society. And I can understand why, as our ethnic community, sometimes don't want to make noises because of the discriminations that we already received in daily basis. And so that intersectionality can play out really well. If you know how to milk it, sometimes I joke about it. Like, you know, in certain sectors, it seems like a value. I'm not counselors. Like, let's say if I'm a counselor, speaking Mandarin, man, gay, you know, like Chinese, Malaysian, I will have a lot of jobs because people needed to see me in that category. But however, it doesn't necessarily play out well if I in my own communities. Because as a gay, rainbow person, as Asians, 53 years old, I kind of become marginalized too. It's very weird, you know, like sometimes that's my head and I don't even know how to articulate this intersectionality, to be honest, because it's just like a logic, you know, like our food, just lump everything together. It can taste amazing, but also when you look at a combination, it feels weird, like.
Because you want to be able to represent your identity so that you can support others, but you will also discriminate yourself in the long run.
Good. Thank you. Articulate. And then the worst thing is, during my work, right, a lot of people ask me, oh, can you represent gay Asian in your communities? And then I said, you need to stop that. Just because I'm gay, it doesn't mean that I can represent my community. I said, I know nothing about the community, because I was in a secure relationships. So I didn't interact with that community at all. I just happen to be gay, having a same-sex husband. That's all I can say. The rest, I have no idea what happens and what's going on within my own community. I say, if you ask me to be Chinese, you know, like represent that in the mental health sector, I feel very comfortable. But I say, don't lump me into, I say, of course I can sit there. I say, but it's unfair because I know nothing about my community. So I can't represent my own community just because I happen to be a gay person. So sometimes you need to be very careful.
Yeah. And people have all sorts of experiences. So for people to say your experience is the Chinese gay experience, so let's listen to this guy for the true authentic story. It's just quite lazy because there's like lots of other experiences that could happen.
Yeah, so I'm very, very cautious about it. For Chinese in mental health, I'm feeling very comfortable in that space because I truly interact with many Asian with mental health from different ages, working in the sector, seeing what's going on from a service provider perspective, but also as a lay person who experience mental distress, and also interact with other fellow, you know, like people with lived experience from ethnic background. So I'm feeling comfortable and I'm seeing a common thread and a common theme that coming through. And so I know when I talk about it, not just my experience and also what I have witnessed and also what people have told me and talked to me about. Yeah, so that intersectionality, sometimes I find it really hard to, yeah. Yeah, so what you just articulated it, thank you. That is so true, yeah.
So you went into studying social science and ended up in the mental health space. One of the places that you worked in for quite a while is Asian Family Services. So thinking about like the Asian community, what were some just key issues that you saw in Asian communities in New Zealand that you felt like you were able to contribute as you are a Asian man here?
I'm going to cry, but it's okay. Don't worry. I feel really sorry for our communities, you know, like because they worked so hard when it came to this country. I've seen so many stories. Either they have great success, huge success, but behind a closed door, a lot of struggle. And also gambling harm minimization was one of the core businesses when I was worked there. And I've seen so many people due to isolation, language barrier, and somehow involved in gambling. And the harms that it brings is heartbreaking. I mean, I often tell people the narrative of between gambling harm with different communities are so different. South Asians have their own story about how it started and then what that mean to that population itself, to many people from China who came to New Zealand with wealth, to isolation, language barrier, somehow involved in gambling and lose everything to nothing, divorce, to people like myself, then having parents who had gambling experience and bring harm to them as a 1.5 second generation. And even now, talking about 1.5 second generations, I know so many young people going through that process of understanding who they are. Yet, some family did very well creating that freedom and let them explore to where they feel suffocated because they didn't know who they are within a dominant culture and their home family environment. And because of that, they experience anxiety, depressions, or even self-harm. And when you talk to the communities, they always have story about other people that they have seen and witnessed experience challenges. And then there's also hidden issues that the drug use in South Asian community is quite high. That's quite hidden. To the service that provider are not meeting our needs. Because as a culture, we're still not able to articulate the challenges that each of us faced. Having these very polarized cultures is not wrong and right. It is what we bring the value to the society is mismatched to what the dominant culture encouraging as behavior-wise from self-determination, autonomy, and having opinions and voices to a collective society where we need harmony, where we stay quiet, put your head down, and do what you can. And that's why, despite the talents we have as a communities, you don't necessarily see the leaderships that stand out from our communities because we just don't behave the way that dominant cultures behave. And so there's so many hindrance that, you know, like make us become invisible in this society where we need to have this mind shift. And yet I can also understand, especially when we're constantly facing discriminations, you know, a narrative that is not helpful to us, we decided just to keep our head down and don't make noises.
Yeah, it was hard enough to be accepted in this country. You know, why would you want to make noise?
Exactly. And that's why, you know, like I can understand why we have all these challenges that outsiders don't know. I call it outsiders, you know, like especially when you're working in an organization that's so focused is providing services for the Asian communities, you are inundated with help requested and required, and often they are not well understood by the dominant culture, and people who carry that kind of responsibility usually have to work harder. You're not just providing service for a population, you always constantly negotiate the space with the mainstream providers and funder as well. And so that is hard work because you can never be, you can never be just doing one job. You're doing multiple jobs that does not come with the job descriptions if you really want to make a difference. Yeah, I don't know whether I answer your question or not.
Do you think things have changed over the last few years or to the worse or to the better? You're shaking your head now.
No, yeah. Since I started, when I have my first job, 2004, and carry on as a mental health and all that, the issue is still the same. We might have more organizations setting out as a not-for-profit, and we might have more people talking about mental health. We might have more people wanting things to change. Yet we still don't know how to create a safe space for those people who need it. We still don't know how to name our challenges as a society and also articulated it and challenge everybody and say, this is what we pretend we're doing, but we are not. And then we don't know how to support our fellow communities when they really face challenges. We don't know how to we might see the stress they carry, but we don't know how to carry how to have those conversations so that they can have the support they needed. We know how to come together to celebrate, and that is a beautiful thing. But when that's finished, when individuals have to go home, might need help, there's no one there that they can reach out. Because our communities still don't know how to hold that space. We might have auntie and uncle, some champions who really know how to hold that space, but then they are inundated with help that, you know, they need to provide. So if you ask me, have we changed? I still talk about the same thing with some of my friends and also other services. We have many organizations doing great things, but they all come together to do dancing, eating, celebrating. I'm not teaching that is wrong. That is amazing. But because of that, the truth still under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
Being migrant is hard. Man, you know, like the uncertainty at the beginning of the stages, securing a job. After that, you know, like try to build a life for yourself, work long hours, isolation, loneliness. We all knew, but you didn't hear we talk about it. We didn't have a show say, let's migrant talk about the real problems. Let's hear their challenges. We never have any talk show like that.
Because again, you don't want to create noise. You just want to assimilate.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And you've been talking a lot about creating conversations so people can talk about authentic experiences. This is the best time to talk about Authenticity Studios. So tell me how it started and what inspired you to create this platform.
With the work that I did from the past, I have seen a lot of people coming through and share experiences, and I managed to set up some group, which is with Live Experience. I have fortunate to share my story on Mike King radio show and then on documentary and many platforms, and I have found it very therapeutic and empower me to become who I am. And I also believe in the authenticity of telling true story. It doesn't have to be the one that like myself, but I do believe everybody have a story to tell. And after I decided, yeah, probably it's time for me to go, which last year, about April, early April, then I was going to set up like my own consultations and working with people doing funding application, which I'm still doing sometime. And then just out of, you know, like, I don't even know what to say. Like, I just want to have a space where I can honor an individual who have become my friends and doing some great work with the communities to talk about their experience. So I invited Eva as my first guest. And when I sat there and having this conversation with her, I just feel right. I just feel right. There is the right space I want to create. And in my mind, I didn't say, oh, it has to be Asian or whatever. In my mind, I just want true story to be told. And so then I just realized that I need to keep going. Whatever I do, it never been like a strategy, always just by chance. And so, yeah, so I started to invite people that I know I have worked with from the past. But I start finding more and more passions about the 1.5 second generation and migrants. I was still open to mental health with people that I know of, which come from a very diverse ethnicities. But moving forward, I want to have more representations from different ethnic background. Of course, mental health will be still a big part of it. But the idea is, it's not necessarily coming and tell sad story. That never been my attention, because I believe real authentic leadership is not based on a prescribed job descriptions, a community leadership, by someone who live authentically from inside out, and that can be anything. And hence, it's a platform to honor individual or who they are, and creating a narrative that based on who they are while I holding the space. So I never tell my guests what they should say or questions. I say, now here, let's hear your story. Let's start from there. So I never have a script, and I never say it has to be a certain way. I just open the door and say, let's walk together and see where this takes us. I've been extremely blessed with so many people, including yourself, that have willing to be part of it. And I really cherish that, because I felt like each story is such a treasure. It's like someone who given you their life and say, you can have it. And so I'm just really grateful to be in a space where people trust me and willing to share with me. I'm not making any money off it. I don't want people to say, to see, oh, he has 74,000 subscribers. Not at all. The reason why the subscriber was so high actually was one of the queer story that I created called A Boy Who Wanted to Be a Cinderella. That, for some reason, drives people to subscribe. And the podcast is still in very early infancy of creating that awareness. So, yeah.
At least you know what people are looking for, the conversations people want to hear. So you did mention The Boy Who Wanted to Be a Cinderella, and that was one of my questions. I do want to ask just some insight from you. What is it about, so people can go and listen to it?
That actually is a story about myself, about who, as a queer person, when I grew up, I always want a prince. But I couldn't find any representations of that kind of story to normalize. It's okay to have a same-sex partner. And so that was out of my own experience, even from the very beginning of the story, where I talk about how many people mistaken me of my fairness of the skin and teased that, you know, like I was the fairest of it all compared to my sisters, and I have this like brown hair as a kid. And also how I tell people that I want to have a prince and being laughed at. And the story somehow kind of have that inner truth about who I am. But also having the contrast of the character who truly want to find love in a place where it's forbidden, and a prince who also wanted to have the same things but carrying the family obligations, and yet never been tested within their family whether that is accepted or not. And both wanting to find true love, but the prince who really wanted it in the end realized that to find true love, he has to first accept who he is. And so that was the story of it. Of course, you have to have a happy ending, but I also created a fairy in the story. Such a crying baby. The blue fairy actually is to let individual who know when I decided I want to be truly who I am, the journey was hard. And how hard it was, I never truly knew. And I don't want people to think just because now I'm 53, it's easy. It's still hard, especially when you just came out from 22 years of relationships. Me and my partner still great friend. I still love him dearly, care about him dearly. But I learned sometimes true love is setting each other free. When I talk about drowning loneliness in my Medium blog, is how sometimes the societal expectations that we have, we build around it, and then it became a system much bigger than who we are, structures much bigger than who we are, and then carry forward with a lot of pain and suffer just so that the structures can maintain. And even walk away from it is still not easy. But at least I know I'm having a second chance to face the truth of who I am. Sometimes to find out who we are, we need to let go of things that have become a structures that we can't hold itself anymore. It's like a society that we created, the social media that we created, in the end it became bigger than us as a human being. And then it ran it on course that we didn't even have control over it. I felt like that was my life. I created something, even though meaningful, lovely, but I was so alone at the same time. And so I realized that I need to, not saying walk away from it, but at least have the honest conversation with my partner, and also having the dignity to acknowledge that if I truly being who I am, would I want to carry this forward? And the answer was no. Yeah.
And it's beautiful to know that you are forever in this journey of relearning and also unlearning things about yourself. And you do talk a lot about this in the channels that you write on, but also you have all these conversations with the people on your podcast. I wonder if you can tell us what's top of mind for you. You know, it's April and I just can't believe that we're already at that time of the year. What are you excited for? But also, how can people find your work? Because I do want people to listen to your podcast because it's, the amount of stories that you have on your platform is just amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. I honestly still don't know where this journey is going to take me to, but I'm certainly committed to it, committed to the podcast. And the podcast name is Authentic Leadership Podcast, which is on YouTube, Spotify, anywhere you type in, you'll be able to find it. And now it's April. Things still unfolding because my partner Jenna is still in separations and he has his plan. I have my plan. So we kind of in this process of finishing off everything. Having said that, I also started a trust that is based on Muay Thai kickboxing that I inherited from my previous coach, who kindly gifted it to me, and a few of my friends now holding a space. So we teach Muay Thai on Wednesday and Friday. And I'm still doing some work around communities where people reach out and say, hey, have you had time to do it? One of them is helping funding applications, but also providing strategy for small NGOs so that they know how to start building profile and also getting a story out there, because sometimes the issue is so hidden, people don't even know the issue existed. And so I really want to help, especially with the Muslim communities that have refugees background, to highlight some of the challenges, but also getting some noise and also changing perceptions about people coming from Muslim background, because they are the kindest, nicest people in the world. Yeah, they are being discriminated by some of the mainstream narrative that I so sad about, because coming from Malaysia, I know how Muslim people is. It's so unfair and unjust. And so I wanted to have more representation on my podcast about people from Muslim background as well, as well having you and someone else to tell a story. Yeah, but I just want to carry on doing justice that happening about our communities and having a story out there so our people can have a better life that has never changed. I know how hard it is to be a migrant in New Zealand. If we don't even help our own people, who will?
You have such a big heart, and I love that you know, you carry your whole self in this short one-hour interview. And this is like really the tip of the iceberg of your story. So I really recommend people to find out more about Ivan on his channels. And Ivan is spelled I-V-A-N, Y-E-O. So yeah, thank you so much, Ivan, for being here today on Connecting Cultures Features. And all the best. I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Arena. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.